find her expert advice anytime at thinklink.com and find her live midday every Sunday on 95.5 FM and AM 750 News Talk WSB.
Rebuilding America, one house at a time. And we'll start with yours today. On News Talk WSB, we've got a, well, there's a whole bunch of really interesting people we're talking to today. But first, let me give you where you can contact me. Questions at thinklink.com is always a good place to go for me to see what your questions and comments are about the show. Thinklink.com is the name of the website, and when you're there, sign up for our free weekly newsletter. It gives you all of the links to thinklink.com content. Be sure to check out the Equifax Finance blog, and if you're not following me on Twitter, I'm at Glink, at G-L-I-N-K, and trust me, you are already missing half the conversation. Today, I have lined up a bunch of really interesting people to talk to. I think that there's just a lot of interesting data, and now we're seeing different information coming back now about the economy, number of jobs. I think there's some really mixed numbers. And so I've got as my guest this hour two economists. We're going to start with Jake Adger, who is the chief economist for RealtyTrack. RealtyTrack has a lot of real estate data, and they have just created their first U.S. residential sales report, which showed that U.S. residential property sales reached an estimated annualized pace of 5.3 million in June of 2013. It's up 2% from the previous month, up 8% from a year ago, which is really interesting. We're going to talk about that in just a moment. The report also showed a national median sales price of $168,000 for the month. That's up 3% from the prior month and 5% from a year ago. That number really speaks to some of the other numbers that I've been seeing over the past couple of weeks. The Case-Shiller numbers showed that property prices are up. The National Association of Realtors are showing that property prices are up. Everybody is showing that property prices are going up. So what does that mean for you today? We're going to talk about all of that on the Elise Glink Show, Rebuilding America One House at a Time. Jake, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
It's nice to have you. So you have been at RealtyTrack. This is your first year there as chief economist.
That's correct.
And where did you come from before there?
SAP, which is a large enterprise software company.
Right. So you're just moving now into the whole real estate experience. Do you own a house?
Yes, I do.
And how, are you an investor also?
Just in the house that I live in. That was all the resources I had.
Well, that'll put you at where just about most of America is in terms of having the greatest amount of their investable assets in their own house. Me too.
That is true.
So let's talk a little bit about why RealtyTrack, which has, I thought, already had this kind of data out there. What is new about this residential property sales report?
Well, the things that are new is that we are now projecting an annual sales figure, which we had not done before. We get sales data from all of the counties across the country, and we have seen a very consistent trend in when the data is reported. Of course, most of it gets reported right away, but there's a long tail of the data coming in over time. So we noticed this very consistent trend, and we decided to do the annual projection because it was so consistent. And so after a relatively short period of time, we could feel confident projecting that annual number.
Mm-hmm. And when you, I'm sure what you did was sort of test this back against years past. How accurate were you compared to what the actual sales data turned out?
Well, we feel pretty confident about it, our accuracy, and of course we did test it going backwards, as you suggest.
And it was pretty accurate.
It was pretty good.
Okay. Good. I'm glad to know. So the number of, I think it's, what, 5.31 million, is that right, of existing home sales?
Yeah.
Is that existing and new or just existing? How is that number actually calculated?
It's existing.
Just existing. All right, so used homes, as some people like to call them.
Yeah.
All right, so 5.31 is a nice step up from where it's been during this Great Recession. We went down to, I think it was even below 4 million existing home sales during one of the years of the Great Recession, maybe 3 or 4 years ago. We've been building back up. We see that new home sales are rising a lot, but as I like to remind my audience, when you've fallen by 80%, going up 10 or 15% sounds amazing but really isn't. Let's talk a little bit about where you think residential home sales should be compared to this nice, it's not a bad number, it's up from 4 million in annualized sales, but I don't believe it's near the record high, correct?
I don't think so. In terms of where we think that we should be going, we think that there are still, or we know that there are still quite a number of homeowners who have who are underwater in their loans, and as that improves, we think that there will be more people who are willing to sell and who are interested in selling at reasonable prices. So what we're hearing, we also have many partnerships with brokers who are doing these deals every day, and we're hearing from some brokers that people are interested in markets where the prices have risen a lot in selling, but maybe even some of their expectations would be too high on price. So we think that as prices go up, people will more homes will come on the market, and they will do so at very reasonable prices, and we'll see more sales going forward.
So cash purchases, in the report, it found the cash purchases represented about 30% of all sales in June, down just a tick from the previous month and a year ago. And most of the cash sales are going on in Nevada, Florida, and New York. New York's sort of interesting. Nevada and Florida are two of the worst states for the foreclosure crisis. New York is actually, I believe, has the distinction of homes in foreclosure staying on the market the longest, thanks to the judicial system, something like an average of 380 days or 420 days or something like more than 3 years. Maybe it's 900 days. So is there a correlation between the whole idea of cash purchases and the states with the worst foreclosures? And will we see cash purchases going up in states like Florida, Michigan, Illinois? What are you guys thinking?
Well, you're right that some of those states, New York and New Jersey, had a 1,000-day foreclosure.
That's right, 1,000 days.
Foreclosure timelines. And the average in the U.S. is a little bit over 500 days. So it's a long process regardless. And we think that that some of those cash some of those states are having a lot of cash purchases now because investors, of course, are very excited about the opportunities that they're seeing with attractive capitalization rates for the buy and rent strategies.
Mm-hmm.
So that's definitely driving some of the activity. And to a certain extent, also credit is tight, and so there are more people coming in with cash because others who might buy are having difficulty getting loans.
So how are we going to push up the number of homes that are sold if we have such a huge portion of home buyers in cash, right? The cash buyers aren't the first-time buyers because they don't have that cash. They're generally investors. And it strikes me that you're going to run into a brick wall. I'm not the economist, you are. But from my armchair, it strikes me that you could end up running into a brick wall with the ever-expanding or the idea of ever-expanding investors. Like, I believe that this is an amazing time still to be an investor in real estate, a long-term investor in real estate, but 30% is nowhere near the norm for investors, for the level of investors. So what are you guys projecting in terms of, when you say more sales and higher prices and all the rest, are you projecting that investors with cash, that number is going to grow from 30%?
Well, what we think, what we see happening in the market now is the those investors chasing the opportunity as the capitalization rates get compressed in some of the markets where there was the most investor activity early on after the crisis, such as the Western states. We would expect to see less investor activity in those areas going forward, and already we're seeing more investor activity, more cash sales in some of the eastern states. So, for example, in Atlanta, we saw, and Memphis, we've seen quite an increase in large investor purchases, which is something that we track separately. We track cash sales, but we also track investor purchases by any entity that has bought more than 10 homes in the same year. So what we would expect is that for some of the markets like Orange County, where we had a lot of investor purchases going on for a few years now, we would see less of that, and that's good to some extent because their inventories have been quite tight in some of these areas. So we would expect that the cash investor purchases would go down as a percentage in some of those markets and then would come up as a percentage in some of the other markets that are more attractive, haven't had as much investor activity up until this point.
So you think it's going to balance out a little bit?
I think it will, and I think that'll be to the advantage of home buyers.
Okay. All right, we're going to take a short break. Jake, if you can stick around for a bit. We have Jake Adger with us. He's the chief economist for RealtyTrack, RealtyTRAC. And you can find them online. If you're an investor, you probably already know about them. But stay tuned. We're going to continue the conversation here, and then we're going to talk about some new credit trends with the Deputy Chief Economist of Equifax. Stay tuned. This is the Elyse Glink Show, Rebuilding America, One House at a Time, starting with yours, News Talk WSB. Hey, welcome back, everybody, to the Elyse Glink Show, Rebuilding America, One House at a Time, starting with yours. We have Jake Adger on the phone with us. He's chief economist of RealtyTrack.com. So, Jake, when I look at this report, there's so much information packed in it, and I know that some of it exists on the web. Is there one thing that you would want either real estate investors or home buyers or sellers to take away from this report and these numbers that you're now tracking? What would that be?
I think that the biggest takeaway that I have is that investors and any home buyers really just need to do their homework when they're thinking about making purchases. And we see that in what the large investors are doing. They're really moving from market to market, setting up operating companies in some cases, which is not a small commitment. But they're moving from market to market as the investment metrics change. Of course, the rents, the purchase prices, the availability of distressed inventory, transaction costs. All of these things should be factored in when making any kind of investment. And I think it's exciting to me to see that's happening. And so I think that overall is a sign of a better functioning housing market when the purchases and the activity is more responsive to the fundamentals.
Great. Thanks so much for your time. Jake Adger is with RealtyTrack, RealtyTRAC.com. We'll put up a link on our website. Jake, thanks so much.
Thank you.
All right, 404-872-0750, online at Glink, at GLINK. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we're going to talk about credit and credit trends. What's going on with the borrowing of money in America? There are some new numbers out, and I think it's going to surprise you. So stay tuned for that, and we will be right back with more on News Talk WSB. everybody, to the Elise Glenk Show, Rebuilding America One House at a Time, starting, of course, with yours here on News Talk WSB. I have Dennis Carlson with me on the phone right now. He's the Deputy Chief Economist for Equifax, and Equifax has recently released its latest credit trends report, the National Consumer Credit Trends Report, which looks at consumer payment behavior, in other words, how well you're paying your bills, and what if you're not, and what's going on with credit in America right now. Welcome to the program.
Thank you so much, Elise. I appreciate the opportunity.
Well, it's nice to have you here. So what did you find in the latest survey?
Well, I think the latest survey results have shown us that things are improving, particularly from a credit perspective. Nearly across the board, we're seeing dramatically lowered delinquency rates. We're seeing, balances are being lowered, particularly on the bank card side. And just in general, I would say it looks like people are starting to come back and have learned the lessons from, what we term the Great Recession. We sort of operate under this paradigm that, the Great Recession has been a monumental event, and it really caused people to rethink how they spend, what they spend their money on, and, just in general how they behave from a credit perspective.
Do you think that going forward that people will do that? Because we know with the Great Depression, right, that changed the way that people thought about money for decades, even generations. I mean, you still today you hear about Depression babies and Depression-era thinking and how that's colored people who are in their, 80s and 90s today. But even those who are a little bit younger who remember growing up in households, they might have been born during the Great Depression, but those lessons in the 40s followed by World War II really kind of hammered home and cause that generation to think about things a little bit differently as well. I don't think this has been quite as bad, and certainly I hope there's no world war on the horizon, but how is it, when you guys talk about this, you and Amy Cruz Cutts, who's the chief economist for Equifax, when you guys sit around and talk about this stuff, do you think there are going to be truly long-lasting consequences to what people have gone through over the last 7 or 8 years?
Yeah, I think that's just an absolutely fantastic question, Elise. When you talk about the Great Depression, the Great Depression babies, my grandmother was one of them, and I remember when we cleaned out her house, she stored these packets of ketchup and soy sauce and you name it. I mean, they were all over the place, and that was her mindset. I think that given the severity of this recession, that folks are still a little bit gun-shy. But was it truly the monumental deep depression that we had in the past? I think that question is yet to be unanswered. I think that, time will tell. We do know that the consumer has become disciplined. They think about credit very differently, and they think about how they use it very differently. Now, how long will it last? Will the good times come back and people forget the lessons, sort of those who cannot remember the past are condemned to repeat it? Or will they, tighten their belts? Just a couple of examples to show where I think it may be longer lasting than we might have anticipated. From an automobile perspective, we've seen a very good second quarter in particular for automotive sales, mm-hmm. As well as from an originations perspective. But what we're finding is that in general people are taking out smaller loans. And they're very carefully choosing the automobiles that they purchase. If you think back to before the bust, people were buying really large cars, generally, gas guzzlers, as you would call it. Now that trend has shifted, and if you look at the reports out of Ford or any of the major automakers, there's a real trend to these lower-priced, more fuel-efficient cars. Furthermore, a lot of people, about 60% of people who buy a used car, originally were thinking about buying a new car. And so there's a real big emphasis, I think, today on making the most out of your money.
Well, I really love that as somebody who's really focused on, saving more and spending less. Do you see the same thing happening with homes? Are people being thoughtful about what they spend, or is it the fact that mortgage interest rates are at historic lows kind of compensating for that, and people are like, well, I could buy something at 4 times my income because interest rates are so low, rather than taking a more conservative approach?
I think that's such a great question, Elise. And what I think we're finding is it's almost contradictory. You know, people may very well take a look for a very long time at, say, buying a television or buying a set of knives, let's say. You know, they'll research it, they'll go to their favorite website and get reviews and really take time to study this decision. And then I think a lot of times when it comes to, you know, probably the biggest purchase most people will ever make, their home, a lot of times they look more at, what will my monthly payments be? They don't necessarily do due diligence in shopping around for the proper mortgage. They may just call up or do something quickly online. So I think, you know, one of the things I would stress is that people really need to get educated. As you pointed out, we have, you know, historically low interest rates. Yes, they're not as attractive as they were a couple of months ago, but if you look throughout history, they're still incredibly, incredibly low. And I think that now is a really great time to purchase a home as long as you keep it within your means. And that looks, you know, consider the total cost of financing and really shop around for the best offer you can get.
So one of the things that I know you found in your report is that the delinquency rates for people who, you know, have mortgages, whether it's a mortgage or a home equity revolving line of credit or a home equity installment, those payment, the late payments, the serious delinquency rates of 90 plus days or more, or in foreclosure, declined sharply. It's year over year, right, that they're declining sharply?
That is correct. I mean, we're seeing delinquency rates, for instance, 30 days plus. So that's people who miss one payment or more, is down about 20% year over year. And so as more and more foreclosures are occurring, we're seeing that they're slowly being flushed out of the market, particularly those big markets like South Florida, Las Vegas, Phoenix. I think that people are now learning to choose homes that they're able to make payments for. And moreover, I think going back to your point earlier about the Great Recession and how it changed people's views, I think it gave them a healthy concern to make sure that if something goes wrong, that they're still able to make payments, that they're still able to keep their household running until they can fix that bump in the road.
So what's interesting to me is it said you've got on your sheet that first mortgage delinquencies, the 90-day more, decreased by more than 27% to 4.14%. I think, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think that's still like four times or even more than four times higher than normal. Just to give people a sense of perspective, because, you know, the extra long delinquencies, I think the delinquency rate or the rate of foreclosure was really only like under 1% historically, right? Or was it about 2%?
I think it was a little bit higher than 1%, but you're right in terms of just to look at my numbers here quickly. So if you look around 2005, which we'll use as sort of a benchmark period.
Before the world blew up.
Before the world blew up, exactly, before, you know, the sky fell. It were right around 2% is what we saw for serious delinquencies, so 60 days plus.
So this is about twice that.
It's still about double that. The question there is though, how much of this is you know, bad loans from the past, people working their way through the system. It's not as if you stop paying and then all of a sudden you're completely flushed out of the system. And so I think a lot of this is simply, the trend is most certainly to work its way back down to where it's historically been, which is a great thing.
So this gets me back to something I wanted to ask a couple of minutes ago, which is that if we're flushing foreclosures out of the system and we're seeing the delinquency, the sort of long-term or extreme serious delinquency rates falling, aren't we really, isn't this really speaking directly to how much better the economy is getting? We're not seeing the serious numbers of people. People are still losing their jobs, but we're not seeing the same numbers of people run through those same huge problems that turn then into serious delinquencies that are 90 days later more. So we're seeing people start to deleverage or get rid of the ones who are the sort of the worst at the bottom, and that's just kind of improving everything for everybody. Is that kind of what's going on?
I think that, you know, by removing these foreclosures from the system and eventually getting them resold and back on the market, you know, that does a nice thing in terms of house prices. So I don't know if, you know, the house price indices have been sharply up, particularly this year. And part of that is these foreclosures finally making their way through the system. But to your point, Lisa, I think it does speak to just in a very slowly improving economy. I don't think, you know, I think we all would hope to see some magic button that was pressed and all of a sudden things skyrocket like a rocket ship taking off. And I think the one story I feel very confident in is that we are not necessarily seeing that rocket ship, but rather sort of a steady growth. Almost, you know, three steps forward, two steps back in some ways, but still the overall trend is definitely positive.
Do you feel, and I'm asking this, I don't know if you actually know the answer, but maybe you could take an educated guess. So when we had the 2001 recession, it seemed like we never really super recovered from that. We had what was called a jobless recovery, and I remember reporting on it. This show was on the air. We'd been on the air for a couple of years at that point. And so I remember, you know, week in, week out, I'd be talking about the jobless recovery, and we still had an elevated number of unemployment numbers for some people filing for unemployment. And then suddenly we had, like, maybe a boom year or two, maybe 2003, 2004, and then suddenly we were thrust back into this kind of really serious recession, much more serious than 2001. Do you have a sense of if we ever really truly recovered from the 2001 recession to even to get back to where we were, let alone grow? Because I know that the growth rates after in really the entire 2000, the aughts as they call them, never really quite seemed to be very striking, certainly not similar to the way we used to have recoveries from recessions.
I think that's a great point. This recession is very different. So there's a lot of different metrics you could look at to your point around, you know, recovery and recovery periods. One that we look at or think about is the amount of time it takes to get back to maximum employment prior to that recession. So the longer that takes, obviously, the slower the recovery. And there's a lot of different metrics you could use. I will say that this recession and this recovery has been far, far slower than not only the 2001 recovery, but any recession we've had in history through post-World War II, in any case. There was a very sharp, sharp decline, as everyone knows, and the growth has been steady uphill, but it's appearing to be a very big hill. Versus where most recessions, you sort of hit that maximum loss, if you will, or where things get the worst, and then it's pretty sharply up from there. Probably the only recession, this sort of parallels is really more the 1990 recession, where there was a sharp drop, and then it actually took almost 2 years to recover. So far we're past the 60-month point, and we still haven't 100% recovered.
Right. It's a little distressing overall. We're speaking with Dennis Carlson. He's the Deputy Chief Economist of Equifax, talking about some of the latest figures that they're pulling out of their numbers. Dennis, stay tuned. We are going to be back in just a moment with the Elise Glink Show, Rebuilding America One House at a Time, starting with yours on News Talk WSB. Back, everybody, to the Elise Glink Show, Rebuilding America One House at a Time, starting with yours. We've been talking to Dennis Carlson. He's Deputy Chief Economist of Equifax. Dennis, thank you so much for being with us today.
Oh, it's been absolutely my pleasure.
All right, we'll have to have you back. I think there's definitely more to tap in there.
Oh, I look forward to it.
All right. When we come back next hour, we have another really interesting conversation with Rick Sharga. He's the Executive Vice President of Auction.com. We're going to talk about auctions and why they have become so popular, especially with banks who have REOs and distressed properties, but also regular sellers. So what are people looking for? How does rising interest rates affect this? And what about prices? We're going to talk about that. And then we're going to just finish up on our little hour on real estate investing with Teresa Bradley Bonta. She is a real estate investing consultant, and she's written a new book about investing in apartment buildings. We're going to talk to her about that. So stay tuned. Follow me on Twitter at Glink, at GLINK. Go to thinklink.com for more information and links for today's guests. I'm Elise Glink, Rebuilding America One House at a Time, starting with yours on News Talk WSB.
It's live, expert money and real estate advice every Sunday. Elise Glink is on 95.5 FM and AM 750, News Talk WSB.
everybody to the East Link Show, Rebuilding America, one house at a time, starting with yours. Here on News Talk WSB, my website, thinklink.com. Don't forget to check out the blog, sign up for the free weekly newsletter, make sure that you take advantage of all things Glink. And while you're there, you can follow me on Twitter, at Glink, at G-L-I-N-K. We're always tweeting out during the show. And if you're not on Twitter and joining me on Sunday mornings, you're missing half the conversation. I do have this ability to talk and tweet at the same time. Not quite sure what else I can do, but those two things for sure. So I have on the phone with me now an old friend, Rick Sharga, who used to be with Realty Track, but is now the executive vice president of auction.com. And somebody who's actually been observing the real estate industry for, you know, quite a while, at least long enough to see this whole thing rise and fall. Rick, welcome back to the program.
Always a pleasure, Elise.
So let's talk a little bit about where homeownership rates started this week, or rather where they were announced, and consumer confidence, because I think both things really speak to where we are in this, I don't know if you can even call 7 years a cycle in real estate, but to where we are today.
Yeah, the cycles have really sort of come off the rails the last couple times, haven't they? Homeownership was pegged at about a 65% rate, which is the lowest it's been in 18 years. And that's caused a little bit of concern among the economists who do follow housing. I'm of the opinion that we haven't seen it bottom out yet. I think we're going to see at least another point or so in decline, probably mostly because we're seeing a drop-off in first-time homebuyers.
Mm-hmm.
And credit remains extremely tight and difficult to get for people that don't meet the profile of that perfect borrower that the lender's looking for right now.
Is the profile changing at all? I mean, are lenders actually getting with the program and starting to loosen up? Because it seems like they are in some areas.
A little bit. As interest rates are going up, it's likely we will see lenders take on a little bit more risk. But offsetting that somewhat is the fact that the new lending rules that the CFPB has put in place are going to become enacted officially in January. So I actually expect to see credit tighten up a little bit more as lenders make sure they're compliant with the new rules by January 14th.
You know, it's interesting. I see a lot of commentary from various parties trying to get some publicity for their point of view, and a lot of people are not happy with qualified mortgages and the idea that the CFPB is saying who is qualified or who is not qualified to get a mortgage. I don't know. I'm not sure I disagree with the idea that somebody actually ought to be able to repay the loan that you lend them in some meaningful sort of way. But what are you hearing out there?
It does seem sort of odd that we would have to tell a lender only issue a loan to somebody who can repay you.
It's crazy, right?
You wouldn't think you'd need regulatory control for something like that, but based on what happened, maybe we do. The one area that I think is really going to be a little bit controversial is there's a lot of discussion in Washington right now about something called disparate impact. And that's a nice way of saying that certain borrowers are going to be excluded from the mortgage market. And these are borrowers that the government would really like to have mortgages available. They tend to be folks at the lower end of the economic spectrum. They tend to skew a little bit more heavily toward minority borrowers. And the problem is that the rules in the qualified mortgage package that the CFPB has put together almost by fiat cause disparate impact. There's a 43% debt-to-income ratio that a qualified borrower needs to have. A lot of people at the lower end of the economic spectrum simply won't be able to meet that threshold, and a disproportionately high number of those borrowers tend to be minority. So the government, on the one hand, is threatening to go after lenders who discriminate, but they put a policy in place that, from an economic standpoint, does discriminate, and so it's really interesting to see some of these unintended circumstances take place.
Right. So that brings up a really interesting question that I hear quite often, or comment, which is that if your housing mortgage taxes and insurance is going to be more than 43% of your income, gross income, which really is more like 60% of your take-home pay, should you really be committing and buying a house? And I have to say that despite the fact that, you know, it's more minorities at the lower level, it worries me that there is this conflict that, you know, because it isn't really a racial issue. It's really about what can you afford to buy. So what we tell people is, you know, you should probably think about spending less on a house. And then that number would get back, you know, in line. So I do, but I do have a problem with that because when people actually, first-time buyers in particular, who you know and I know, they have no idea what's in store for them because the minute they get there, it's just like, oh, the dishwasher broke. Oh, the roof is actually leaking after the first major rainstorm in Atlanta. Oh, I need to blah, 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 blah. And so suddenly this house where you've so carefully apportioned your dollars and cents is going to cost a whole lot more. And I think there are always those kinds of surprises for people.
The cost of home ownership is a great mystery to people who haven't gone through it before. And as a country, I'm afraid we're becoming more and more financially illiterate when it comes to preparing the next generation of homeowners. This goes back to the thing we started talking about first, which is the home ownership rate. I'm not somebody who's wringing my hands over the home ownership rate dipping. It peaked at 69%, and what we did is forced people into homes that really weren't ready for the financial responsibility or simply didn't have the finances to afford these homes. I was talking to somebody last week about the difference in the interest rates being at, you know, 4+% instead of 3.5%, and for most people, it was, you know, less than $50 a month on a 30-year fixed rate mortgage. And bottom line is if that extra $50 is going to keep you from buying a house, you shouldn't be looking at buying a house anyway.
Right.
So yeah, I think, you know, we are looking at responsible lending. The government obviously has, you know, some political concerns in addition to practical concerns. But I don't think it's necessarily a bad thing that people that can't afford a house are going to find it harder to buy one.
No, at least not for the short run. What concerns me, and I'm sure what concerns you, is that affordability has really never been as high as it is right now. In other words, more people can afford to buy a house today than have ever been able to do so. And when interest rates go up, as they inevitably will, what will that do to affordability? You know, you've got prices rising and mortgage interest rates are going to go up, and they've already gone up, you know, a bit. What does that do for affordability for everybody else? I think more people will fall into that pot that's outside of the qualified mortgage arena where they just, you know, and it'll be minority and non-minority, but everybody who is at the lower end of the income level will end up falling into that pot. Do you think that FHA might be able to step in and kind of bridge the gap for some of those young first-time home buyers?
Well, first of all, let's go back to the basic premise. We're at a very unusual point in time in the housing market when we had a 35% decline in home prices from peak to trough and interest rates hit all-time historic lows. So mm-hmm. The affordability numbers were off the charts. We'd have to go significantly further than we've gone already in terms of home prices increasing and interest rates increasing just to get to historically normal levels of affordability. So we're still at a very positive point in time in terms of affordability. As prices go up and interest rates go up, obviously affordability goes down, and it will keep some people off the market. Having said that, as interest rates have gone up, what we've seen is home price appreciation slow down. So I do think you have that sort of economic balancing act that goes on in the marketplace, and those rising interest rates will actually keep us from getting into a housing bubble anytime soon in terms of prices overshooting real values. To your second question, I think FHA has already done a wonderful job of stepping in and making it possible for first-time home buyers to get into the market. In fact, if there weren't FHA programs out there right now, I would submit there'd be almost no first-time home buyers entering the market today because most of the borrowers simply don't qualify for the traditional conventional loans that the rest of the lenders are offering. So
even at these low interest rates and even at these low home prices, they still don't have 20% or 10% to put down, is what you're really saying.
They don't have the down payment, they don't have the credit history, they don't have the job history, and that becomes a real issue. So FHA guidelines are a little more relaxed, and they'll allow somebody to get into a home for as little as a 3.5% down payment. So for any of your listeners who are first-time home buyers looking for an opportunity to get into the market, I'd really encourage them to look at FHA-backed products.
You know what's interesting is FHA has always has allowed and was expanded to allow that payment to go up to 43% of gross monthly income, which is now where the qualified mortgage thing is looking to go to, right? That was always the purview of FHA. For a conventional loan, it was always up to 36%, right? It wasn't even, it was 28 and 36%. And so for them to do a qualified mortgage up to 43%, I think is kind of a huge expansion of what was considered realistic.
I think they shot for the highest common denominator there in order to not shut off the flow of lending entirely. I mean, keep in mind that the lending institutions themselves have clamped down from a risk perspective so in such a draconian manner that very few people can qualify for the loans in the first place. Excuse me. And the loans that are being issued right now are going delinquent at rates roughly half of what we've seen historically. So I think the CFPB was wise to not come out with rules that were more difficult to meet for borrowers than what the lenders are already accepting. And so they didn't build less risk into what was already a risk-free marketplace for those lenders.
Right. No, I think that's a good point. So at auction.com, what are you guys selling these days?
We've sold about $20 billion in real estate since the online platform was developed in late 2007. And there's really three areas we're focusing on right now. We do a lot of distressed property disposition, both in online auctions. There's about 12,000 properties for sale on the website right now at auction.com. And we do trustee sales for trustees in a lot of the states that do non-judicial foreclosures. So we're in about 30 counties in California, for example, where we'll go do live auctions of properties that are in the foreclosure process. And that opens up the bidding opportunity for a lot of potential buyers, whereas it used to be sort of a backroom operation that only select local investors could play in. We're also doing a lot of commercial sales online. And luxury properties. We recently sold a $10 million property in Atlanta. And so those are the three areas that we're really doing an awful lot of work in at the moment.
That sounds pretty good. I am talking with Rick Sharga. He's Executive Vice President of Auction.com. Rick, when we come back after break, stick around. I want to ask you what you think is going to happen the end of this year into the beginning of the magical 2014, when we heard that all was going to be well. All right? All right, you get to think about that for the next 2.5 minutes. I'm Elise Glink. We are rebuilding America one house at a time, starting with yours on News Talk WSB.
Every Sunday, Elise Glink is live and here to guide you through your money and real estate questions. Only on 95.5 FM and AM 750, News Talk WSB.
Hey, welcome back, everybody, to the Elise Glink Show. Rebuilding America one house at a time, starting with yours. My friend Rick Sharga is on the phone with us. He's Executive Vice President of Auction.com, where they're selling all kinds of stuff, $20 billion since 2007 online, which is just amazing. So, Rick, as we were going to break, I asked you to pull out your crystal ball and tell me what you think is going to happen over the next 6 months to a year in real estate.
Well, first thing I think is going to happen is that we're going to see an increase in the inventory of available properties. As home prices go up, we'll see existing homes enter the market. As builders complete some of the new homes that they've begun to develop, you'll see that inventory go up from the 30-year lows we're experiencing right now. And I do think we'll see more distressed property come to the market as the lenders finalize some of the foreclosures that have been in place, held in place for the last year. So, you know, a year from now, I think we could be looking at potentially more inventory than we have buyers for, and we could see a shift from a seller's market to a buyer's market. But I expect that we'll finish this year with slightly more than 5 million residential units being sold. Probably price increase by the end of the year at somewhere in the 5 to 6% range. I would expect 2014 to be fairly similar in terms of sales volume. Although I think the price appreciation will slow down as the inventory levels pick up.
Sounds like a good plan. We'll see if you're right. I'll bring you back. We can see if you're right.
I hope I am.
I hope you are, too. It would just mean that everything's getting a little bit better. Rick Sharga, Executive Vice President of Auction.com, thanks for being with us today.
Anytime.
All right. I'm Elise Glink. We are Rebuilding America One House at a Time. Stay tuned. I'll be back with more in a moment on News Talk WSB. Welcome back, everybody, to the Elise Glink Show, Rebuilding America One House at a Time, starting with yours here on News Talk WSB. Don't forget to check out my website, thinkglink.com, thinkglink.com. If you want to read more of the different things I've written, you can go to CBS News, check out my Money Watch blog, Home Equity. You can also find me on the Equifax Finance blog, where our next guest is there as well. Teresa Bradley Banta is a real estate consultant. She's the author of a brand new book called Invest in Apartment Buildings, which is about investing in real estate, specifically apartment buildings, and she's done a bunch of that. And I thought it would be really helpful for those of you who are thinking about investing in real estate and have heard me talk about investing in real estate and why I think this is such a great time to hear it from somebody else. Teresa, welcome to the Elise Glink Show.
Thank you, Elise. Thanks for having me participate. It's great to be here.
So you've written this book, Invest in Apartment Buildings, but I'm pretty interested in the consultancy aspect of what you do. I should say that you have a website, TeresaBradleyBanta.com, which we will put up as a link on the thinklink.com blog so you can find it. But you have been doing this kind of investing in real estate for a while, and you've built a consultancy about it. So why don't you talk for just a moment about that?
I'd love to. And as you said, I have been investing in both single-family properties, and then I later moved into small multifamily properties and eventually apartment buildings. I consult with investors who desire to move into multifamily investing, say they have a background in single-family, and I also consult with owners of buildings who need somebody to come in and assist with the operational aspect of the managing the property, such as lowering your property expenses or increasing the property income.
Okay, and so how long have you done this kind of work?
I've done it for about 4 years, officially, through, you know, my brand and my site.
And what are you finding are the biggest mistakes that people make when they're moving from single-family homes into commercial property, or even just with managing commercial property? What are the pitfalls?
Well, one of the greatest pitfalls is buying into the hype around you get rich quick investing in real estate. You can do it with none of your own money.
I love that one. That's my favorite.
I know. Or that you sit back and watch the rents flow in while somebody else does all your headaches and talks to the toilet flushing issues and manages the property for you. And the pitfall there is if you buy into that, you stop looking at it as a business. And it really truly is a business. It does take time, it does take education, and it does take knowledge, and it's particularly with larger properties to be successful at it.
Yeah, I think it does take time. I mean, you do get lucky from time to time. So I have some friends in Atlanta, and I was there last week having a coffee with him, and he was telling me that they had moved their offices from Buckhead, which is kind of, you know, this really nice area in Atlanta, up to sort of north of Alpharetta where they live. And what had happened was there was a sort of a strip of commercial properties, three buildings, that went into foreclosure and just sat there and sat there and sat there. And they finally, their lease was up in Buckhead, and they're like, well, we should probably see what those buildings are like. And they were able to buy them. They were about 23% leased, and they needed to get it to 43% to be cash neutral. And meanwhile, they needed to move their own, you know, themselves into it as well, their business. And so 6-8 months later, they're up to 70-something percent leased. They're making money. They're in there. They're the poster children for doing it right because they understood what the headaches were, the real estate lawyers. They kind of have these other businesses. And it strikes me that when you are a small business owner, you know, buying the place that you're going to be in, buying that commercial property, if you understand that there's room to grow, if you understand how it fits in with your business, that could overcome a bunch of the mistakes I see early investors make.
I couldn't agree more, and that's just a great story of your friends.
What are you
really remarkable? You know, one of the my favorite ways of getting started in investing in real estate is to actually get out in a neighborhood and start driving around and picture yourself buying the building, picture yourself owning it, just like your friends did. And it's an amazing way to find good deals. And, you know, so back to your point about it being luck, and there's so much to be said about that, but if you're not out actually just in the neighborhoods, looking at what's out there, picturing yourself owning it, that you're creating your own luck. And you're finding the deals that aren't listed through brokers or online, just as your friends did. I mean, that story just is such a great story to how I like to have people get started. It's just a great way to get out and set that intention of ownership and actually make it happen.
Who do you, I know you spend a lot of time in your new book, Invest in Apartment Buildings, talking about who should actually invest in multifamily units and multifamily buildings. Why don't you talk a little bit about that? Who do you see as sort of the archetypical, you know, multifamily owner?
Well, a good place to start is single family properties because you've already done some deals. And, you know, you've closed on a real estate property, you've gone through the due diligence, the jitters of actually buying real estate. So that's a good first step. So I see people moving from that successfully. I also see people that just come in and buy a 160 unit property. And, I think that type of person has a lot of confidence and, but
a lot
more
of cash.
Importantly knows how to put team around. They're surrounded by the people that are going to help them take over ownership.
Yeah, I actually am a big believer in team. And in fact, in my own webinar series called Intentional Investor, How to Be Wildly Successful in Real Estate, I spend a lot of time talking about team building because it isn't even just finding the right agent or finding the right mortgage lender. It's setting them all up so that they know each other and they are all focused on the same page, and they all are moving in the right direction, the same direction you want to go in. And when you've got your team members sort of focused on what your goals are, what your dreams are, what your financial realities are, they can help put you in a spot for success. And building that kind of a team, it's really like building a business. You know, I think a lot of times the mistake that I see people make with investing is that it's kind of an ad hoc gut thing. And I've done that. I've been in, you know, I went to an auction once and found myself bidding on property and found myself winning that property. And it was not anything I'd planned for before the evening had begun. And that's really just, it worked out fine. But it was also the second or third property we've bought. But for most people, it wouldn't have worked out fine. And it almost didn't work out fine for us over the long run. And so when you kind of have intentions, the intentional part of investing, I think, is important. And having the intention of building that team together has got to be right at the top of the list. And I think people make mistakes there.
I totally agree. And I love how you have the team communicating with each other and knowing and meeting each other. And if I may, I'll just add one thing, because it's really daunting for people to think, how do I build a team? And, you know, you're not going on Craigslist and advertising for all these people.
Oh, God, no.
It's just your networking. Your broker knows people. Those people know people. Your lender knows people. You know, it just goes on and on. And then there are warm referrals, warm leads, so you pick up the phone and you've already got a name to use. But I love your concept of having everybody know each other and know the end goal. That's brilliant.
So when you are working with some of these people, where do you find that the process breaks down for them? You talked about working with somebody who's bought a 160-unit building. And it seems to me that even just analyzing 160 leases to make sure that you understand what each of those leases says, or your attorney is analyzing those leases, that, you know, there's really, you know, you've got to have an engineer for a building like that, at least a full-time engineer usually, preferably one who's there on site and is living in the units. You probably are not living in that kind of a building, as you're probably pretty well off. But where do you find the process breaks down? And maybe it's not a 160-unit building. Maybe it's a 6 or an 8 or a 10-unit building. But you're getting into some different types of sizes.
You know, I think number one place is you have the wrong team member on the job. That's what I see over and over. Whether it's you bring in a single-family property manager to manage your 8-unit property, and they've never managed that type of property before, or it's a, you have a single family house renovator start renovating your apartment units and they're over renovating everything, or even on, in the case of like the 160 unit property, you may have just the wrong manager in there. They haven't done that type of building. So that's just speaking to management alone. It, every team member this applies to. And I really think that is the most critical element to success.
In your book, what would you say, we just have a couple of minutes left, but what would you say is the best piece of advice that you have been given and that you've put into practice that you could share with us today?
Oh, that's a great question. I think the best advice I've had is, well, it's two things. A, do your due diligence. So do your inspections. Don't get in a hurry. Don't fall in love with the property. With commercial real estate, you'll be in contract on multiple properties before you actually close on your first one, because that's when the negotiating happens. The other thing, now I can't even think to my second point.
Well, I think your first point's really interesting, because I do think that people underestimate the time and the energy and the money that's involved in just going through and making these offers, right? You really can't, you make these offers, and commercial offers are very different from residential offers. Residential offer, you might have a contingency for the inspection, you might have a contingency for the financing or an appraisal that it has to appraise out in value. In the boom times, you would have contingencies for golf courses that, you know, if it was on a golf course community and you couldn't get into the golf course community, there'd be no point in buying the property. But for commercial property, there tends to be many, many more contingencies. And there are so many other ways to places to negotiate and ways to sort of step out that I think that people really underestimate what the time involvement, the knowledge required, the cost of that always is. And it's unfortunate, because that's where mistakes happen. You're listening to Teresa Bradley Banta. She's the CEO and founder of Teresa Bradley Banta Real Estate Consultancy. Her book is called Invest in Apartment Buildings, and you can buy it at Amazon, iTunes, Barnes & Noble. She's got a great website that you can go to with her blog on it, TeresaBradleyBanta.com. So you can take a look at that as well, and get more information about investing in real estate. Teresa, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thanks so much for having me, Elise.
I really appreciate it. All right, we're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll wrap it all up and talk about next week. All right, this is Elise Glink, Rebuilding America One House at a Time on News Talk WSB.
Expert money advice you can depend on anytime at ClarkHoward.com and midday every Sunday with Elise Glink on 95.5 FM and AM 750 News Talk WSB.
Welcome back, everybody, to the Elise Glink Show, Rebuilding America One House at a Time here on News Talk WSB. Well, it's hard to believe, but our 2 hours are up. I want to thank our guests today. They were just absolutely terrific and full of great information. Jake Adger of RealtyTrack.com. Dennis Carlson, Deputy Chief Economist of Equifax. And I should mention that the Equifax sponsors the Equifax Finance blog, which I'm the managing editor of. Rick Sharga, who's the Executive Vice President of Auction.com. And Teresa Bradley Banta, the CEO and founder of Teresa Bradley Banta Real Estate Consultancy. All of these people will be up on our blog with some information, some contact information, links to the websites if we talked about different research studies or whatever that are available. All of that, we will connect whatever we can on the blog. And, of course, follow me online at Glink on Twitter, at GLINK. Sign up for the free weekly newsletter and pretty much join the ThinkLink community. That's what I think you ought to be doing. Well, by now, I hope you're hearing music. I know that I'm hearing it for sure. Go and have a great week, everybody. I'll be back next week with another edition of the Elise Glink Show, Rebuilding America One House at a Time on AM 750 and now 95.5 FM, News Talk WSB.